Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Respiratory. This podcast aims to bring you expert perspectives from a multidisciplinary team on the management of rare and unusual neuroendocrine tumours, also known as NETs. Specialists in the MDT involved in caring for patients with NETs discuss individual patient cases to highlight new and emerging approaches to diagnosis and treatment, and the impact of effective multidisciplinary teamwork and coordination on patient care. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from Advanced Accelerator Applications and is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME. In this podcast, a medical oncologist, an endocrinologist, a nuclear medicine specialist, and a nurse specialist discuss the current and emerging treatment options for a patient with a well-differentiated pancreatic NET who now presents with progressive disease.
Hello, my name is Diane Reedy Lagunes, and I'm a medical oncologist and the Associate Deputy Physician in Chief at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in the U.S. I'm joined today by my colleagues, Dr. Thomas Hope, Nuclear Medicine Physician and Director of Molecular Therapy at UCSF Health in San Francisco, also here in the United States, as well as Professor Marianne Pavel, an endocrinologist and Chair of Endocrinology at the Friedrich Alexander University in Erlangen, Germany, as well as Ms. Catherine Bouvier-Ellis, who is an expert in the field of neuroendocrine nursing and founder as well as CEO of the Neuroendocrine Cancer United Kingdom in Leamington Spa. In this section, we will be considering the question, managing disease progression, considerations for treatment selection and sequencing, focusing on the management of progressive pancreatic neuroendocrine cancers. And I'd like to present the following case. This is a 62-year-old gentleman who was actually asymptomatic, but was starting to get a little bit more fatigue, not for a very long period of time, interestingly, and eventually got cross-sectional imaging that identified a very large liver lesion, which you can see on this one cross-section of a CT scan, biopsy proven to be a well-differentiated grade 2 pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor. Again, he had lost some weight and feeling nauseated, although not for a significant period of time, interestingly, despite this very large burden of disease. So, Marianne, I'd like to start with you. In a patient with a G2 pancreatic neuroendocrine cancer, how do we know what to start with in terms of what's the best first-line treatment?
Yeah, that's an important question. Thank you. I think you already pointed out the key issues of the individual patient. He has a high KIR67, and it's still not G2, but it has also a high tumor burden. And our primary goal is to downstage the disease. And we don't have so many options with the treatments being available, reaching from somatostatin analogs to targeted drugs up to chemotherapy and PRRT. We have few compounds available that can really achieve high objective response rates. And that's particularly true for temozolomide-based chemotherapy. We have from the study presented at ASCO with the final results on temozolomide versus temozolomide plus capecitabine, objective response rates of around 40%. So that would be a preferred choice in patients with a KIR67 above 10% that are rather moderately proliferating and have a high tumor burden. Because somatostatin analogs alone are quite well tolerated, but objective response rates is less than 5%. The same is true for everolimus and is also true for sunitinib as an approved anti-angiogenic drug in pancreatic NET. We still have the PRRT, but we lack prospective data. And we know from retrospective series that objective response rate may also reach 40% or even 50%, but this needs to be consolidated by prospective trial data. In that respect, COMPETE study and the Oclurandom study, PRRT versus sunitinib, will be very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, That's exactly what happened with this patient. He did receive the combination of capecitabine plus temozolomide. He actually was enrolled in the ECOG study that was the study that you just discussed, that capecitabine plus temodar was favored over temozolomide alone. He received an exceptional response. We actually always stop the therapy at about 9 months. There was recent data, as I'm sure you know, that if you're on temozolomide, which is an alkylating agent, for longer than a year, the risk of bone marrow damage goes up substantially. And as you said, there's several other therapies that we'd like to keep in the toolbox. So we do want to be mindful of the potential side effects of all the different therapies, because we don't want our patients to have lowering of the blood counts. And then this patient actually was maintained on treatment holiday for close to 3 years before disease progression again. So very interesting biology sometimes after you're on this type of therapy. But I think it is important for our clinicians to understand that, you know, all of these therapies have side effects, particularly the bone marrow suppression that we worry about, because we want to be able to offer all of these different therapies to our patients. Then this patient did eventually go on to develop progressive disease, again, after 3 years off of that therapy. What now? What would your multidisciplinary team, again, assuming you would take this back to, you know, the specialty team and the tumor board, what would an option be here, and what clinical trials, if any, would you consider for such a patient?
Well, I think there's three options on this table for this patient. One is actually liver-directed therapy. It's liver-only disease, no disease, it seems like, outside of the liver at this time. The second is actually, I think you could even consider repeat CAPTEM, right? This patient's a remarkable responder to CAPTEM. It does not mean you can't go back to that treatment. And we oftentimes do this with PRT. If you get a treatment with PRT with PNET and you have a 3.5 year time to progression, I'd go back to PRT as well. And obviously the third in this case shows good uptake on a dotatate PET. And so PRT is also an option. The problem with CAPTEM and PRT as a pairing is they both hit the bone marrow. And so they actually interfere with one another in terms of the ability to get subsequent therapy. So you only have so much marrow reserve available to get so many treatments. And so I think that's one of the issues you run into with PRRT and CAPTEM. So I think that the question of what do you do up front, I think that's, I have equipoise over PRRT and CAPTEM overall. Bulkier disease, I'd prefer CAPTEM. Higher uptake on somatostatin receptor PET, I'd prefer PRRT. At this time point, I think it's a little even more unclear, actually, because now that you've had such a good response to CAPTEM, it's actually reasonable to go back to that. Also good uptake, apparently, on this imaging study for PRRT. And then we'd also have our IR doctors take a look as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And could you comment, either you or Marianne, on some of the other clinical trials that may be available should this patient opt for a clinical trial?
Yeah, sure. There's a number of trials out there. So there is the COMPETE trial, which is a randomized phase 3 study in G1, G2 GEP-NETs versus everolimus. The COMPOSE trial is in G2, G3s compared to sort of a basket of everolimus plus CAPTEM or FOLFOX. So it can be chemotherapy or everolimus in the control arm there. There's also another trial, which is going to be coming out of Alliance, of CAPTEM versus lutetium dotatate, which just opened as well. And so there's a number of these studies that's coming out to evaluate prospectively PRRT versus either everolimus and or chemotherapy.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we have the CABINET study also, which is cabozantinib, a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, which also could be considered. I think, Kathy, when we talk about targeted therapies versus cytotoxic therapies versus liver-directed approaches, any insight in terms of, you know, in sort of patient selection, side effect profiles, and things that you talk to your patients about?
Well, I think, you know, we all want to offer the best treatment with the least side effects, right? I mean, that's the aim. But, you know, one of our sort of key messages is always around, you know, the quality of life that this treatment or a treatment choice is going to offer. So I think, you know, having those full discussions again with the patients, putting out there on the table what is possible and what each of those side effect profiles might look like, because their lifestyle is going to be as important, you know, in terms of what they can manage, what they feel they can deal with. I mean, this guy, you know, he's 3 years been quite stable, I think you said, and, you know, that scan result's going to be hugely disappointing. And I think there's a lot to manage in terms of, you know, trying to prepare him for the next stage of his barrage of treatment. So I think it's really important that, you know, we step back and we have a think that our aims and our goals and his hopes are all aligned when we're looking at the different treatment options.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And Marianne, we often notice that as the tumors progress, often they can change the pace of the disease. Any unmet needs or conversations that you may have with patients, particularly pancreatic progressive tumors, because like often the biology can change, and does that change your management when that might happen? And in particular, do you ever like re-biopsy, or does that even help?
Definitely, it's a very important issue. I think if the pace is getting very fast, it may have happened that the patient switched to a grade 3 neuroendocrine tumor. There are data in the literature that report that every second patient has a change in grade with pancreatic NET particularly. And this may have an impact on the choice of the treatment. I mean, Tom just mentioned the COMPOSE study. Academically, it's a very interesting study because patients can be randomized to either PRT or the physician's choice. So, and this is everolimus, temozolomide capecitabine, or FOLFOX. So that patient already received temozolomide, so would not be a candidate for that study. But it's interesting that we would even consider FOLFOX. And FOLFOX would be a treatment, for example, if the patient would have now a KIA67 of 40 or 50% after rebiopsy. In that respect, I would consider rebiopsy also if I have heterogeneous evolution of the lesions. Some lesions being stable, some lesions growing, and these lesions are frequently then escaping also to treatment and may not be an optimal candidate for PRT. Then FDG PET scan is required maybe to see if there is mismatch of lesions, and it requires again a high expertise level of the nuclear medicine physician to really discriminate differential uptake in different lesions. And it's time consuming. You really need to dedicate that time to the assessment and the tumor board. So that is very important to consider. And I think the TKI, you mentioned that this is an emergent therapy, particularly in those having low uptake. They are not the best candidates for PRRT, neither for somatostatin analogs. So we have then limited options, just chemotherapy or the targeted therapies like everolimus or sunitinib. But happily, the treatment landscape is expanding towards axitinib, surufatinib, that is under exploration also in Europe and US, and it's already approved in China. So there are upcoming new treatment options that may be very interesting to the patient. And of course, also new radiopeptides like alpha emitters that may be interesting too.
Absolutely. So again, emphasizing the importance of a multidisciplinary approach and access to these clinical trials, not only for our patients of today, but of our patients of tomorrow, so that we can understand the science and improve outcomes based on evidence and data. So Marianne, Tom, Kathy, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic at www.touchrespiratory.com. Don't forget, there are 3 other chapters in this series, so please listen in for further insights from the multidisciplinary team.